A red letter N unfolds into a spectrum of colors.
Well, if people ask me, what do you want people to get from this movie?
Right.
My answer is, depends upon what they bring to it.
I wanted to make something to honor the people and work that I revered. And in the process of making it, I found myself so into it.
You do know what's there, and you can feel it, the palpability of it, that you just go with it, you use it, and you adhere to what the message is, and that message is love at the end of it.
It resonates with so many people.
Blur the line so that there can be a confluence of thoughts of how we want to lead together to move forward as a family, to move forward as a film family, to move forward as a country, et cetera, et cetera.
I was doing ADR somewhere, and you walked in, and you saw me. So which play you want to do?
That's right.
What you talking about? So there it was. I was like, okay, well, we're going to do it. Somehow we're going to get this done.
Text appears. The Piano Lesson, Legacy and a Vision.
I'm Doreen St-Félix, and I'm so delighted to be here with the cast and crew of The Piano Lesson. We have Michael Potts.
Whining Boy.
Katya Washington.
Producer.
Samuel L. Jackson.
Doker.
John David Washington.
Boy Willie.
Malcolm Washington.
Director.
Daniel Detweiler.
Bernice.
Denzel Washington. And Todd Black.
Willie and Maritha touch the piano.
You feel that?
She nods.
That's your family. Your blood.
There are so many moments in watching the film where we can feel the 21st century, the century that Wilson didn't get to see. There's a real sense of the modern while also very much being a period piece.
It was important for me to make a film that could speak to the current times, that could function in the current times,
right.
Have the language and images and sounds of today, because I think in Wilson's work, moreover, there's been so many iterations of his work and the themes that he wrestles with have stood the test of time in so many generations. And I wanted to push that and see how urgent can we make it? How contemporary can we make it while always revering the time it was in, time it was made, and the time it's representing in the 30s?
There's reverence, but there's also a willingness to change, to excise, to adapt. When you were looking at the script, you know, before you started filming, were there choices that the screenwriters had made that had surprised you?
The surprise for me was how much of August's dialogue they actually kept.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great reverence for what he had written. There didn't seem to be a need to kind of adjust the story or adjust the dialogue. So that surprised me. Because
mm-hmm.
I'm reading it, I'm going, oh, this is like the play, isn't it? We still have the same language.
Right.
The cinematic aspect of it, reading it,
yeah.
I was always saying to Malcolm, it's a 3-hour play, it can't be a 5-hour movie. So what are we doing? And to be able to keep, like Michael said, a lot of the dialogue and still go outside and see them driving the broke down truck, see them go sell watermelons, to go to Parchment Farm, to do all those things and open the play up that way and still maintain the integrity, basically, of what the play is.
And with the film, too, you have a different tool set. So there was a lot of language that we might have taken out, but those same ideas were expressed in performance.
Mm-hmm.
And things were said in a look or a gesture or an action that didn't necessarily need to be said with words. And any time that we can take something and put it into action on film, visualize it, and express the same idea, I think is honoring the medium that we're working in.
Mm-hmm.
And we were blessed to work with some of the greatest actors working in our time that were able to do that.
The ghost of the yellow dog got sucked.
Say what?
They found her the next morning, say he drowned in his well. We thought it was funny, great big old 340-pound man gonna fall down as well.
Men's silhouettes watch Mr. Sutter fall down an endless well.
Malcolm, in the very beginning, to Denzel and Katya and myself, was super clear with what he wanted. And he wanted it to be a visual movie. He didn't want it to just be in these three rooms, you know.
Right.
Besides going outside and opening it up like you talked about, it was very important to him that inside, that each room and the piano evoked a certain visual look. And if you look at the film, even the lighting in the film, you know, it's very, very specific. And Malcolm had such a almost instinctual eye along with our terrific DP. And I think, you know, in thinking about it and in watching the film, everything that I think you were going for, you achieved.
And another thing that I really loved about the camera work was how balletic it was. It felt like a dance, so the actors were allowed to dance and the camera was dancing right along with them. And I think it brought the sort of life to the visuals that the language evokes.
We looked at a lot of photographers and the filmmakers that raised me, you know, Terrence Malick and Spike Lee, Malik Saeed and Khalil Joseph. These are the people that informed my visual understanding of filmmaking. There's so many conceptual ideas that we're trying to establish from the beginning of the film. You know, there's a theme of Black American reclamation, retelling our story, declaring it, and setting up these ideas of color with red, white, and blue, of texture and the elemental kind of motifs that come through of water, fire, earth, wind, all these things. We wanted to set up into the visual language and tell this story, interweaving with what the actors are doing and what the story's kind of doing on its surface, is provide a bed for that visually, sonically, to really help tell the story and give audiences something to chew on even after the movie's over.
I was thinking a lot about painting as I watched. I was thinking about Kara Walker and those haunting silhouettes.
Exactly.
Because there's that feeling of presence but absence.
Yes.
People are here and not here.
Yes.
Everyone's entering and leaving. And I've been thinking so much about your embodiment, because it feels like an embodiment, Michael Potts, of Whining Boy, and how you see his relationship to the family.
Well, Whining Boy shows up.
He walks into a room.
Basically, because he needs to see his brother.
They hug.
I think it's early part of the film, you see him, he's in Kansas City, he's playing the piano, and he reads this letter. He's just found out that his estranged wife has died. This is a man who's showing up grieving to begin with and saddled with guilt that he wasn't there.
He points.
Because he keeps saying he's on his way down home. And you go north to Pittsburgh before you go south to Mississippi makes no sense. So clearly he's carrying a lot with him, and so he needs to talk to his brother, to be in the bosom of his family, to try to figure out his place in the world again. And so he ends up in this conflict between his niece and his nephew about what to do with the family legacy.
Bernice ain't gonna sell that piano because her daddy died over it.
I'd love to get into the granulars of the individual relationships, beginning with Bernice and Boy Willie, because you are brother and sister, but there's so much distance and fracture there.
It's 5 o'clock in the morning and you come in here with all this noise. You can't come like normal. You just got to bring all that noise with you.
The foundation was the admiration that he has for his sister. I think he loves his family so much, like you were talking about. He just needed to see his brother. Well, he needed to see his sister. He's carrying a lot of guilt in the paradoxical relationship he has with God, faith, religion, even in the dynamics of the family, you know, and how he was raised. I mean, he's seeing that they were raised by the same parents, but yet we have a different experience. He's trying to get, you know, some understanding and maybe some support from her, I think, aside from the piano and his hustle. So the love was there at the foundation. I think that's what I was trying to find, and I'm seeing how, you know, the actress Danielle, how she just turns into the energy that's needed to tell the truth. You do know what's there and you can feel it, the palpability of it, that you just go with it, you use it, and you adhere to what the message is, and that message is love at the end of it. And then, you know, you have the conflict, obviously, with what we see, what makes it entertaining. But the foundation of it, the bond, and the lessons that were taught by their parents.
Mm-hmm. We're both coming with a particular kind of rigor for faith. I think we're both having a fight with God of sorts. Yeah, for sure. And just thinking about Bernice's like battle with accepting Avery as a partner, that's not a thing that she's rushing directly into because she's still fighting with God about what has already occurred, about the loss of their father, about the loss of Crawley. The loss of the land, for that matter, right? Like, I'm not there anymore because I had to run from this thing. So this inner faith quandary is what's wrestling between the both of them. But because there has been that gulf, right, of time, that gulf of distance, there is a lack of ability to have the clarity in what we're both, you know, dealing with. Right. We haven't had a conversation about the fact that we've lost our parents.
Yeah.
And that's such a...
She cranes her neck.
That's such a treacherous thing, because what we're essentially talking about is conflict and the lack of ability to have the communication about that conflict.
And confrontation.
Yeah.
Issues left unattended.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. That's interesting about your battle with, you know, your relationship with faith and religion.
Sure.
I didn't think about that.
Because, I mean, we've been weaving what the arc was for Bernice to travel from Black American Christianity rooted in tradition. I have to do this thing also because of gender, but then throughout growing to something much more intuitive, something much more rooted, right, in thinking about hoodoo and thinking about West African spirituality, that is something that everyone who's in the room when it happens are being pulled and, you know, conjured to, because ancestral lineage is speaking, and you have to listen when ancestral lineage is speaking.
Mm-hmm. I also want to add real quick, too, I just think about my personal life. There's a bit of a tax, I think, Boy Willie's putting on his sister for leaving. I think about, like, when I went off to college, I feel like there was a little bit of a tax.
It was a tax.
I got from my siblings. Like, you left us. I'm like, I'm going to college. Yeah. I'm trying to get an education, to better myself. For the family.
For who? Yeah. Right. For, who?
For my parents, you know. Yeah. No, but, you know, and so then I think that might be at the root of him provoking his sister in a way, like, you left, you got out of here, but really I'm proud of you, but also, like, I got to mess with you, and don't ever forget that you Mississippi just like me.
And so I didn't have a choice. Because violence drives us out. It's not purely upward mobility that's driving us. It's I have to literally survive. They right. literally killed my husband. I don't know what happened, but I got to get out of here because I have a child.
Right.
And so what is happening to us or has happened to us cannot happen to this one.
Mm. Right, exactly.
Sound like in hindsight, we need some reshoots.
We do a sequel.
Y'all got all kind of smart after the movie we made. Didn't have none of that shit with you when we were shooting it.
John doubles over.
Cutaways.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's messed up. No,
you had it.
Thank you.
It reminds me though of everybody says, so, you know, what did you want to bring to the movie? And Denzel always says to whoever's ever asking
that.
People
ask me, what do you want people to get from this movie?
Right.
My answer is depends upon what they bring to it.
That's all I'm trying to do with that piano.
Boy Willie stares.
Trying to make my mark along the road like my daddy done.
They're both fighting about their experience with their parents and what their parents' lives mm-hmm. and legacies meant, and they have a different view on it. And they're both what, in a way, fuels each of their characters. And they're trying to get through to the other person.
You always talking about your daddy, but you don't never stop to look at what his foolishness cost your mama.
I wanted to ask you, Sam, about your personal relationship with the play, having played a different character mm-hmm. at Yale, now playing this character. I feel like your sense of the interiority of all the characters has developed or changed as also American history has gone on, you know?
How the world changes and what causes people to end up where they are, the migration pattern, the whole thing. We talk about, August talks about migration. And Doker being the one who got out and getting out from Mississippi to Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a regular job, he's on the railroad, but he went through the same things that everybody's gone through. If you grew up down there, you went to parchment, rite of passage. Mm-hmm. They picked you up at some point and put you in your place and let you know what that place was. And when you get out, you carry that kind of stuff with you. So knowing, like when I first see him and I say,
he squints.
What you doing up here? I thought you were still not in Mississippi. I thought you were still in jail.
When'd you get out?
Yeah, you know, that's the question. You said, when you get out? Yeah, you know, that's the real question. So analyzing that and him knowing he's here for something, and knowing him, when Lyman finally says, is this the piano? It's like, oh, here we go. We go on, this is what's happening now. Every time something happens, they all end up back there because Doker is that stable place and she came to live there after her husband died. Mm. She moves on in with her daughter and, you know, he
shakes his head.
Let her. Yeah, there was no question about it. You know, it's a family thing. My brother's children, yes. So now he's that patriarch. He's the keeper of a whole lot of stuff. Oh. And he knows that...
He waves his hand.
His desire to do what it is he's really trying to break that chain. But even if he gets that land and he owns it, at some point they're gonna come get him and put him back in parchment because that's just what they do. And the world, we have a whole thing about us and the way we look at what's going on around us. That was then, this is now, but we still have that same thing going on around us. But no matter what that is.
He draws the circle.
Our lot in life remains the same. We have to take care of ourselves, you know, and that's what this is about, this family taking care of itself in a society that doesn't care.
I think that's what's so interesting about the conflict that your two characters kind of find in the story, too.
Yeah, he loves him, but he also knows that he's bullheaded and, you know, he crosses the line at one
he's
point.
He's a habitual line, you know, stepper, yeah.
Totally crosses the line, you know, you gotta go and I go get my pistol and, you know, and look at you, and you gotta look at me and know, I will shoot your ass, you know? I will shoot you, you know? And
it started like that. You started with a gun on him.
Yeah, well, you come out of the house with your gun. I mean, people knocking on your door at 3 a.m, waking you up.
Yeah.
I mean, there's great reverence, though. I mean, my father and my uncles, they took the piano back. Like, you know, risking your lives to do that. You know, y'all have quite a rep at Parchment Farm. Mm-hmm. And I get respect because of y'all's reputation. So I'm like, I hold y'all very high. And that sort of dynamic plays when I first embrace Unc, when he comes in, I'm like, oh my goodness, you're here.
He grins.
You know, it's like, this. I'm trying to take what y'all have built and started and make something even bigger.
My daddy, he spent his whole life farming somebody else's land.
Whining boy furrows his brow.
I ain't gonna do that.
It's interesting, marriage and fences, you know, a professional relationship in Ma Rainey with her musicians, and now this with family. They love each other, like you said, and that's your nephew and you love him. But at the same time, there's that built-in conflict of self-preservation. And you might be family, but this is also the conflict that I'm having.
Everything's like in perfect orbit.
Yes.
It's like,
yes.
It's not too much where the planets are crashing into each other,
right.
Nor are they spinning apart.
Right.
You're constantly in that golden, you know, dynamic.
Which is why I think it resonates with so many people, though. August had such an amazing way of just making you feel, it was all relatable.
Well, because he had an ear. The thing about August Wilson was that he was at the bar, he was at the club, and he was listening.
Yeah,
and that's right. How he reproduces right. This dialogue that's not just dialogue, it's talk.
Correct.
Right?
It's music.
It's music.
Yeah. With Fences.
We were doing
a Q&A,
right.
And this red hair, white Irish guy stands up at the end of the Q&A, and he looks to Denzel and he says, thank you for telling a story about me and my dad.
Mm.
And with a thick Irish accent.
Yeah.
And Denzel's like, there you go.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Mm. These are gigantic themes. Mm-hmm. You know, belief, family, ancestry, lineage, these are big ideas that tie all of us together.
We're operating on the level of myth.
Exactly.
We're using American history.
Exactly.
But to tell a myth story. Mm. There's this interview that August Wilson did, and he's talking specifically about the piano lesson, which in many ways is like the most difficult play to adapt. And he says he wasn't necessarily sure about the ending. And he always said that he felt that a film director could maybe see something that he didn't. And his own work. Mm. And it made me curious about, Denzel, when you made this pledge, right, to make sure that the plays in the American century cycle would become films, what was the thinking about what the camera can do that is not necessarily better, but just different than what we see on the stage?
I didn't have to think about that. What I had to think about was, who do I need to hire that can think about that?
He leans forward and looks around.
No, seriously.
I remember that part.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, it doesn't matter what I think about the piano lesson. It matters what he thinks about it.
He points.
You know, I was doing ADR somewhere, and you walked in, and you saw me, so which play you want to do?
That's right.
What you talking about? So there it was. I was like, okay, well, we're going to do it. Somehow we're going to get this done.
But you always said, you know, you wanted to make sure that you're matching the right vision up with the right play, and you know, just you've carefully selected that.
And it ain't a science, because you could be wrong. You can want to do all of that, mm-hmm. and then go, oh shoot.
Yeah.
Whew.
He smiles.
I love, too, that the bringing it to life cinematically, the accessibility of it, not just right. obviously on digital platforms and all that, but literally how we take a lot of the language that he wrote and use it visually, you know? Mm-hmm. And like now it's relatable in a way that moviegoers, not necessarily theatergoers, can enjoy and interpret and then have maybe a conversation with the theatergoers that know him in other ways, in a different platform. So like this whole like theater versus, you know, film, Crips and Bloods kind of thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? There's now a common dialogue because of an understanding of how the story was brought to them.
And it's a motion picture. So you get to see now.
Exactly. Right.
Well, that's the beauty. I think the binary is being wiped away in the totality of the film process, right? Like there's an intergenerational connection that is happening in that, oh, I don't got to think about it. You got to think about it. And you think about it from a different expansive point of view. But those viewpoints are coming together, which is connecting to the greater theme of who gets to lead, right? Who gets to lead in this family? Does it have to be this one or this one? Does it have to be this way or that way? No, let's move through this liminal space and blur the line so that there can be a confluence of thoughts, of experience of how we want to lead together to move forward as a family, to move forward as a film family, to move forward mm-hmm. as a country, et cetera, et cetera.
That's my girl.
I think we use the word cinematic so vaguely. Mm. And I think a lot of people think of like really big set pieces or like big action sequences. But when I break that word down, I think of image and sound and how they connect to each other. And what's so crucial in Mr. Wilson's work, moreover, is his consideration for music. We wanted to take a bold step out and really put music on the forefront.
Thank you.
And bringing in a composer like Mr. Desplat to come bless this project with his perspective, because he comes from a different part of the world, the different set of influences. He understood the mysticism, the mythical nature of this piece, and I think brought such a wonderful counterpoint to some of the other music that's in the movie, mm-hmm. and brought this really rich score, orchestral, haunting sometimes, ethereal at other times, and then finishes it with a really beautiful blend of all these things in like a big classical finale that when you see the play in the theater, there's a certain respect of it being, you know, up there, right. and the curtains and the beautiful theater. Like he brought the proscenium to the film
right.
in a way that I thought was incredible. And tied all of this stuff together.
Right, and he also, I think, increased that feeling of we're not just in realism, right?
Exactly.
With the sound.
This is a heightened thing.
Right, exactly.
And there's big moments where you can feel the drums, you can see the whole orchestra here, and we ride it till the wheels fall off.
So maybe Malcolm, to wrap up, where do you want your film to live? How do you want it to affect people? How do you feel?
When I came into the project, I was thinking about it, a lot of the ways that we've been talking about it right now, which is, you know, making something that was accessible, breaking the barrier to entry that's the theater, whether it's money or space, if you're too far away from it. And I wanted to make something to honor the people and work that I revered. And in the process of making it, I found myself so into it.
Boy Willie slaps the table.
I found my family stories reflecting back on me from the screen. And I think so deeply of my ancestors that made decisions and actions that paved the way for me to be sitting on this couch talking to you about a film that honors them. Mm. So what I hope people get is that relationship, is that mirror for themselves, that when the movie ends, that they think of that long line of people that came before them, that fought and sacrificed, and maybe made some mistakes and maybe conquered some other things that seemed unconquerable at the time to make their life possible. That became the most powerful thing in this whole experience for me.
The Piano Lesson. Audio description by Descriptive Video Works. Written by Felicia Teeter. Narrated by Jazzy Frizzle. Copyright Netflix 2024.
A red letter N unfolds into a spectrum of colors.